You're listening to the Apple Insider Podcast.
Thank you for joining us today for episode 133 of the Apple Insider Podcast. I'm your host, Victor Marks, and joining me is Neil Hughes.
Victor, how are you?
I'm brilliant. How are you, sir?
I'm all right.
You know, I want to go ahead and let all of you out there listening know that we have some great deals. You can save from $70 to $250 instantly on Apple's mid-2017 MacBook Pros with no tax in 48 states, and that AirPods are in stock with free two-day shipping. Apple Insider readers can use exclusive coupons to save on the mid-2017 MacBook Pro, and sales tax will not be collected on orders shipped outside of New York and New Jersey. This is through our good friends at Adorama, and we are happy to do it. The deals inside this are both promo code and link activated, so you have to go to the article that we'll link to in the show notes and click through that link and then apply the coupon code AP Insider in the same buying session. If you try and save the links for later, it'll generate an error, so you really have to go ahead and all in one go, click through the link, use the coupon code, and you can save anywhere from $70 to $250 off. For many people, that's an additional savings of roughly about $140 to $335, depending on how you configure the MacBook Pro. So this is a good thing to take advantage of if you've been looking for a new laptop. And as I say, Apple AirPods are in stock. Neil, you had some experiences with AirPods, didn't you?
I've had a few, yeah.
Yeah. And I know you had the PowerBeats 3. What is the best thing about using AirPods?
AirPods are the best commuting headphones. They're okay for working out. They get the job done. I'm still a little paranoid that they might fall out, so I don't use them for that. But I have gone on runs, and I've never had one fall out. But it just feels weird that it's not totally secured, but they're perfect for, you know, I'm getting on the train. I want to pop them in, listen to something for like a 20-minute ride. And then you get off and you pop them back into their case, put them back in your pocket. The music automatically pauses. They just work. They work fantastically, and they're going to get even more capable with iOS 11. Now you'll be able to do separate controls for tapping the left and right earpieces. So currently, no matter which one you tap, it'll pause or do Siri or whatever. But with iOS 11, you're going to be able to do one command for one side and one for the other, which is pretty cool.
Excellent. You know, there are a lot of people that think of the voice-first world, and voice-first comprises things like, you know, app like Amazon Alexa and the Google Home speaker, and now Anchor's getting into it, making an Amazon Alexa enabled speaker, or the Apple HomePod. But really, Siri was the very early indication of this voice first kind of revolution. And putting AirPods in the ear in that sort of world gives you a seamless access to saying Siri, "Hey Siri," or having Siri talk to you without having to interact with the phone or press a home button or have it charged or anything like that. You just simply have them in your ear and you start using it.
Yeah, it's nice. It's Apple's more subtle entry into the wearable devices market.
And also to the spoken AI market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, this is one of those things where you have to have a internet-connected device in order to use Siri. You have to have either Wi-Fi working or you have to have LTE working,
right?
Especially if you're out in the world using it. Mm-hmm. You'd have your phone in your pocket, you'd have your AirPods in your ears, and you can say, "Hey, Siri," and interact without having to touch anything. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's been missing out of that piece is the Apple Watch. The Apple Watch has always been dependent upon having a connection to a phone.
Right. It will do Wi-Fi on its own if it's near a known Wi-Fi network that was established on your phone. But yes, if you leave your phone at home and you're not near like a known hotspot or something, then things like Siri become basically useless.
We're talking about the possibility of an Apple Watch that has an LTE connection inside it.
Yeah, I mean, all signs point to this happening this year. I know you and I have talked about it a lot, and you know, there were some questions to whether they would be able to do it. We now have three pretty reputable sources all saying that this year's Apple Watch is going to have an LTE optional model. So that's about as good as you're going to get short of an actual confirmation from Apple.
Now, one of the reports suggests that voice calls will not be supported.
Yeah, I mean, voice calls in the cellular dial a number sense. And the reasoning behind that, this is some speculation by Ming-Chi Kuo, everybody's favorite analyst. And, you know, the idea is that Apple wants to focus on data first, and also an interesting element, bringing calls into the mix to be able to, you know, dial just anybody's number, even a landline from your watch, not only complicates the contractual process of working out, what people are going to pay and what the services are for a connected wearable, but it also creates technical considerations because most of the carriers in the U.S. are not doing voice over LTE currently. They're doing it over 3G. And in order to fit the modem and have it be, you know, good for battery life into a watch, the expectation is this radio is going to be LTE only. So the rumor is that Apple's not going to offer traditional voice calling through a phone number on the watch for those two reasons. It makes it easier for them to negotiate lower rates and make it a data-only device with carriers, but also it allows them to just use an LTE radio, which makes it so that they, you know, they get faster data speeds and better battery life, but it also makes it difficult to do phone calls. So,
well, there are regulatory concerns that come into that also. When you have a traditional cell phone device, you have to be able to call 911 and you have to be able to have them geolocate about where you are, right? That was what E911 was about. Uh-huh. And if this is not a mobile device that places calls in any traditional sense, then maybe it doesn't comply with those, right? How would you call 911 from a FaceTime call?
Well, but that's the thing. It's rumored to include FaceTime. So.
Right. That's what I'm saying. And so, you know, FaceTime is not a traditional phone service.
Right.
Right. And therefore, you don't call 911 from it. And maybe you don't have to. I don't know. Maybe they've worked this out already. But it's as you say, very different than a traditional phone device.
I think that there's going to be workarounds for this anyhow. A lot of carriers offer calling over Wi-Fi. There are services like Google Voice, there are services like Skype and what have you that allow you to get a number. And so this might be an area where Apple is just expecting that third-party apps and their own FaceTime as well are going to fill the void, and make it so that you can make phone calls over data that at some point are, you know, transferred over to traditional cell phone service through the service, and traditional phone calls. So I think that, you know, assuming that they allow developers to do that kind of thing, you could see a situation where you just install the Google Voice app on your watch or Skype or what have you. And if you want to, you can use that to initiate calls outside of the realm of FaceTime built into the device. And otherwise, you know, it's just not meant for that. But what I found very interesting about Ming-Chi Kuo's note was he said that one of the reasons that Apple wanted to do this is because they wanted to focus on making the watch. He suggested that they want to make it more responsive and more a better experience for users. And I found that to be interesting because what he was suggesting is that the process of tethering the watch to the phone right now is actually slowing down the watch in some ways. And so he seemed to be saying that adding an LTE radio would improve the performance of it and give you more instant access to data, perhaps even letting apps load faster and stuff like that. And it makes some sense because if you think about the first watch, watchOS 1, when it came out, offloaded the processing of apps and stuff, which is why you couldn't have native apps on the watch. It offloaded that to the phone and had the phone do the work and figure the phone has a bigger battery and whatever. Apple, over the years, has found ways to be a little bit more efficient to run apps natively on the device and realized that people weren't interacting with the device as much, which allowed them to have a little bit more leeway to get away with having the apps run directly on the device, even with the first generation hardware. So it sounds like adding an LTE radio may actually improve it in that sense, and perhaps combined with a faster chip, presumably in a Series 3 watch, just lead to an all-around better experience where the apps load faster, the data comes in faster, everything is just working faster. The question then becomes, and we talked about this a little bit last week, if you add LTE to a watch and you start relying on your phone less and your watch more, those savings in battery that Apple saw because people weren't interacting with the watch as much, do they start to go away because now you're raising your wrist more and interacting with the device more? Does that end up hurting battery life in addition to the inclusion of LTE? And I'm just positing these questions because we don't know, and we won't know until we get our hands on the device. But these are the kind of things that Apple internally is dealing with and probably even unsure of in some ways, just as they had ideas about how people were going to use the watch when it first came out, and they turned out to be totally misguided. It will be interesting to see when Apple is announced and launches if any of those factors come into play and people see dramatically different battery life because of their use of it is changed completely.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the interesting things that happens is that even if you start to use the watch more interactively, the watch usage has been, let's say, passive, where you're viewing stuff or receiving information from it, mm-hmm. right? Primarily. That if it becomes much more balanced, if you're using it now as a way to respond to things or to create reminders or to create calendar events, things like that, that I think you use Siri a lot more to do that, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah. And having Siri always working, as you were referencing earlier, with an LTE capable watch makes a big difference, I think. You know, wearable Siri is way more convenient. Just today, I didn't have my watch on. I was getting out of bed and I pulled my phone off the dock and I laid it down on the bed face down. And then I wanted to turn on the lights. And so I was trying to tell Siri to turn on the lights, but because because the phone was face down and I had my watch on, the Siri command didn't work. Because it has to be face up, whatever. So that's one of those things where having the wearable device or in the future having a HomePod in your house will address that rare situation. But those things do happen.
So when you turn on your lights, you say, "Hey Siri, turn on the lights." Is that essentially it?
Correct, yeah.
And because the phone was face down, it doesn't work?
Mm-hmm. I put it face down on my bed, and because your phone is it's interpreting as it being in your pocket or whatever. It uses the sensors on it. The same technology that's being used in the newer A9 and A10 chips or whatever to turn on the screen when you lift the phone. It's also using some of that same technology between the screen being covered and all that certain functions are turned off. And so if you lay your phone down face down, the screen automatically turns off to save battery life and if it's in your pocket and what have you. But it also disables automated Siri commands, which is the same reason that you can't invoke it while your phone's in your pocket. So having if I had my wrist watch on at that point, you just raise your wrist and you talk to it, it's done, it's easy, and it works instantly. You don't have that though if you're not wearing the watch. So again, it's one of those things where or AirPods or anything like that, those capabilities become more convenient and more instantly accessible because of wearable devices.
Now this is not a completely sorted out piece of knowledge, right? We understand that it's very likely to happen, but there's still a possibility that it could ship with the Qualcomm modem. It could ship with the Intel modem.
Yeah.
And
we have conflicting reports on that. Yeah. Bloomberg said it would have a Intel modem and Ming-Chi Kuo says it'll have a Qualcomm modem. Obviously both could be right. And it could be like an iPhone 7 situation where they're splitting the duties on it. We will see. I don't think it really matter in the end to consumers. It may be a regional market thing too. It may be that one modem is better suited for certain frequencies and carrier compatibility in certain parts of the world. The other thing that's interesting is there was a rumor that came out last week, and we addressed it that Apple might introduce a redesigned Apple Watch this year, a completely new look for it. That was from John Gruber of Daring Fireball. He did update his story after he published it to take a softer stance on it and say it was from an unconfirmed source or whatever, someone that he wasn't really trusting as much. But since then, CNBC and Ming-Chi Kuo have both weighed in to say it's going to have the same design. Now, again, that may be one of those situations where both are right and maybe it's not a radical redesign, but it looks sort of the same, kind of like the iPhone 7 looks mostly like the iPhone 6S, but not quite. And maybe not. We will see. But I think the expectation now is softened a little bit. Don't expect like a brand new look or a circular watch face or anything like that. I think it's going to look mostly like the previous watch.
What we know is that when Jony Ive and his crew of designers, his team, arrive at a design that they think is the epitome of what a thing should be, that they aren't quick to change away from it. They will refine it, they will modify it, but they don't abandon it for the sake of a timeline. Oh, another year has passed, we got to change the shape, is not a requirement if they are content with what it is.
Yeah, and that makes sense. Obviously, new designs help drive sales, especially in some markets. But you also have to look at what you're doing internally. And from a business perspective, you know, people hate to hear this kind of stuff, but I mean, Apple's in the business of making money. So from a business perspective, sometimes maybe it makes sense to keep the same design, not invest in that, and save it for a year where you don't have a lot of new features, right? So think about it this way. If they introduce LTE this year and it looks mostly the same, people want to buy it just to get LTE because they're a runner, because you know, they want to just leave their phone at home and not have a distraction while they're out at dinner or something like that. That's a selling point for a lot of people. And then that allows them potentially to hold off on a major redesign or a circular watch face or what else anything else they could do until next year. And then that drives more sales for that year. You know, it's in Apple's best interest to kind of spread some of these things out and not try to do too much at once as well. Because when you try to do too much at once, then you end up with some of these, you know, so-called controversies that have happened in the past to a lot of companies, including Apple. You know, AntennaGate with the iPhone 4 was addressed with the iPhone 4S. BendGate with the iPhone 6 was addressed with the iPhone 6S. And while those were not the controversies that were played up to be, they were still, you know, issues with the design of it that had to be addressed in next year's model. So I don't know that you want to do something like introduce LTE and a new way of interacting with the watch and more interaction with the watch and do a redesign and potentially tick off all of your customers that have bought all these bands already for the watch that maybe don't fit it now. You know, like,
well, how much do you want to do? It's a way to tank. I mean, that would tank your watch series 2 sales completely, right? There are people who may well want an Apple Watch but don't need to buy the LTE one. They'd be happy buying the sport version of the series 2 watch.
Yeah, they may have no need for that. So,
and when you do something that's so radically different, you depress the sales artificially,
right,
of the other version.
Yeah, which is something that they'll probably see this year with the iPhone 7S and 7S Plus.
Possibly.
You're going to have a completely new design on the iPhone 8. What is that going to do for iPhone 7S sales? Where do they price it? How do they, you know, there are so many questions there. It's going to be very interesting to see how they deal with it.
Well, there, I think, because the rumors all push to indicate that the cost of the iPhone 8 is going to be exorbitant, that there are people who will simply rationalize and say, I'll get the other one because it's priced much less. Mm-hmm. Right?
Some.
If it's not priced appreciably less, then that changes the equation a little bit. But if it's priced as they traditionally have been and the other one is significantly more, then people will stick with the one and just, you know.
Yeah, you wonder how many people go, well, I can't get it. It's not in stock at the store and it's too expensive anyhow. I'll just wait for next year when it's more available and it comes down in price.
Right. All justifications for making the decision the way they do.
Yeah, you know, I don't want the 7S because it's not as cool as the 8. I can't afford the 8, so I'm going to take a pass this year. I don't know if that's going to happen, but it's a possibility.
Well, I think it's going to happen for some. The question is, does it happen for a large number?
Right.
And normally our expectation would be no, but there are some number of users who said the same thing when the iPhone 7 rolled around, and now they're on a 6 or a 6S that is becoming much longer in tooth.
Well, that was what I did. I buy new phones every year, and I got an SE. I had a 6S. I got an SE because I didn't really care about 3D touch. And then the 7 came around, and it was like, well, this is a nice phone, but I have no interest in the 7S or in the 7 Plus because I don't want a phone that big. I want the dual camera of the 7 Plus, but that's it. And then you look at the 7, and it's like, well, what am I getting? I'm going to lose the headphone jack. The camera is basically comparable to the previous generation one that I already have.
Unless you get the Plus model.
Unless you get the Plus, which I'm not going to get. So it was like, for me, I looked at the 7 and it was like, well, there's no way I'm buying this thing because I just don't see, I don't see the appeal. I don't see the need for it.
But at some point you have to make this kind of move. You know, as you say, you buy new phones every year. I do not.
Well, I don't now. I stopped.
Yeah. So in the house, the two iPhones that are currently in use in the house as primary iPhones are an iPhone 6, 128 gig, and an iPhone 5 32 gig. And as you know, that iPhone 5 is end of life.
Yeah.
That it's a 32-bit processor in a 64-bit apps world.
No Touch ID.
No Touch ID, but the user who uses it can live with that. But the notion that there are going to be no more OS upgrades, there are going to be app updates that pretty much make the apps that are on there useless over time, because so many of the apps that you have are not standalone products. They're products that work with a website, Amazon, for example.
Right?
All it takes is for Amazon to change the way they communicate between the app and their servers, and only the 64-bit version of the app gets updated, and the app on your iPhone 5 is now useless.
Right.
And that happens for video streaming services as well. You end up with a phone that very quickly becomes an object of art, less than a phone. And so now I got to figure out what's the correct path here. What are we going to do? Are we going to turn that iPhone 5 into an iPhone SE? Are we going to turn that into something else? I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure what I'm going to do either, because, again, the iPhone 7 is a great phone. It's not that I think that it's a bad phone. It's just for my particular use case and what I prefer and what I would want out of an upgrade. There was really no sense for me to go from an SE or even the 6S to a 7. Because while I don't really care about the omission of the headphone jack, it's also like, okay, I'm going to upgrade and then lose the headphone jack, and the camera is basically the same as the previous one. So what am I going to do? Get like the jet black model? That's going to be my thing, or the 256 gig capacity, which would be nice, but those just weren't enough to convince me to spend like $900 on a phone. So I'm very curious to see this year, because I would be inclined to go for the 7S if it had the dual camera. But all indications are that it's not. It's still going to have a single camera. So if you want the dual camera, you're going to have to either get the 7S Plus or you're going to have to get the 8. And, you know, I don't know if I'm going to want to spend $1,200 or more or whatever on a big phone for the iPhone 8. I'm not sure. I got to wait and see what they announce. But I was thinking about this last night, and, you know, obviously Apple's technology over the years tends to trickle down to other devices, legacy devices, whatever, which is how we now have a $330 iPad that's an amazing iPad, right? Doesn't have some of the bells and whistles.
Or the SE that was largely an iPhone 6 kind of
6S,
thing.
Actually, no.
6S,
yeah,
right?
It was the same processor and camera as the 6S. So you see it trickle down to the cheaper stuff, and it leads to some great products. And so I was thinking today, how awesome would it be? I don't know that this is going to happen, but imagine like 3 or 4 years from now that Apple's solved all the OLED problems. There's plenty of OLED out there, the design, whatever. How awesome would it be if we had like a iPhone SE size phone with the edge-to-edge display, or even like go back to an iPhone 4, 4S size phone with an iPhone SE size display. No bezel, top to bottom. You have a really small phone. You have a screen size that, you know, matches the one bigger size than it, you know, that previously existed. So imagine if you had an iPhone SE with an edge-to-edge display that was about the size of an iPhone 7, right?
Okay. I'm going to say a couple of things to this, because I like the idea. I like where you're going with it, but counterpoint a little bit. One of the things is that even when people – so people like large displays, right?
Right.
But there's something about the physical size – that people seem to gravitate to, even if the display is larger on the smaller sized device, that people still like the idea of having something quite large. It's not exactly explainable, but it's certainly observable.
Yeah.
Right. And then there are all kinds of things that factor into that, the same way that spending more equals better quality, the same way that people have these perceptions.
Sure.
That maybe aren't necessarily true, but they factor into buying decisions.
Yeah.
I want the good one.
Yeah.
I want the big one. I want the one that's meant for semi-pros, right? The other thing that I think is important to factor in here is we're talking about this from a primarily American standpoint, North American standpoint. Mm-hmm. You're in New York. I'm here on the East Coast. We understand this in the context of North America. But there's India, there's South America, there's China, which have very different, let's say, demographics and economics and what it means to spend that much money on a phone, and also the social status that it has. You know, I saw people walking around with belt clips. And in North America, we don't see belt clips very often. People don't really wear belt clips. Phones go in pockets, right?
Right.
The point was to have a case that had a circle to show that it had the Apple symbol on it.
Of course.
And then have a belt clip that allowed it to face out so that everyone could see that you were carrying the Apple device, because this is a status symbol.
Your iPhone belt buckle.
Dude, how better to show that you are a person of means than to show that you have the iPhone?
Oh, Lord.
This is a thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, we talk a lot about developing nations and developing world and developing economies and how people are using electronic payments, not unlike Apple Pay, but you know, using M-Pesa, for example, in Kenya, mm-hmm. to make payments, things like that. Using and there are a lot of Android devices that get sold into these countries, and not just the off-brand, no-name ones that you've never heard of in North America, but the main brand ones, because people aspire to those brands. People aspire to own a Samsung or aspire to own an LG,
right?
Because it's the device that has the better name, and it costs more, but it's in their buying decision worth it. And iPhone is a part of that.
Yeah.
So the question is, what does Apple do to make these devices that are capable, that are priced accessible to more people while still holding the status symbol,
mm-hmm.
right? There are all kinds of equations that go into this, all kinds of considerations that have to be placed, because it's a different market. But Apple sells the one phone,
or
technically the three or four phones,
yeah.
but still, it's the one thing called an iPhone.
Yeah.
So your trickle-down technology really does work for those markets, but
it takes time.
It takes time, and does that still have the same status symbol over there? Is a good question.
I mean, I think so, because it's not like Apple stuff is exceptionally cheap. I mean, Amazon's selling tablets for $50. A $330 iPad, while it's a great value, is still one of the more expensive tablets on the market. You go to the store and check out, and most tablets gravitate toward the $500 price point, because that's the price point Apple established back in 2010. You know, you have some higher end stuff, Microsoft Surface going for that market. You have some cheaper stuff, but 500 is where, you know, the nice Samsung tablets or whatever are playing. They're playing in that $400 to $500 range. And you've seen Apple kind of go in two different directions, cheaper and more expensive. But they're still a premium brand in the sense that it's not like cheap junk, and it's not priced as cheap junk. They're not selling a $150 tablet or anything like that. But, you know, if the Apple Watch is a great example, where I think they're down to, you know, $260 now or whatever on the Series 1 watch, $270, somewhere in that price range. If they could get the Apple Watch down to like $199 with the current equivalent of a Series 1, or, you know, whatever they wanted to change it, doesn't have to have GPS, you know, maybe get a little bit more onboard storage, up to like 16 gigs or something like that. I mean, that's, we talked about a few weeks ago when the iPod lineup was reduced down to just the iPod Touch, and how the Apple Watch is the successor for a lot of those smaller iPods, the Nano and all that. I think a $199 Apple Watch, especially if, you know, a few years from now they can get to that price point and make it completely independent of the phone, and maybe even work with an Android device or something, I think they start mopping up the wearables market at that price point and those capabilities. I think that it's game over, because, you know, you're looking at a Fitbit that's going to be $100, $150 for the most part, although they have way more expensive Fitbits. But if you're going to spend $100, $150 on a Fitbit, then you start to look at the $200 Apple Watch and go, oh, it's not really a bad price, right? And you get that status symbol, you get that quality, you get all those things you were talking about. And it's still not cheaper than the other options on the market, but it is at a competitive price.
Yeah. The reason that I see people wearing Fitbits is either because of price, or because they're aiming for a slimmer, sleeker device that is more jewelry-like than the Apple Watch.
Right, yeah.
You know, the Alta, for example. And there are still the holdouts that Pebble will be reappearing somehow in some form from Fitbit.
Nope.
I know. But there are diehards out there.
I liked my Pebble. I had it for a few years before the Apple Watch came out. It was geeky, and it was not the greatest device, but what it did pretty well. And it had a decent developer community. And yeah, I was generally pretty pleased with how some of it worked. And there were some things that worked on the Pebble that still work better than the Apple Watch does. Like, for example, one of the things that I really liked was if I started a run on Runkeeper on my phone, it automatically hijacked the watch and started displaying the status of my run. I can't do that with the Apple Watch currently. I have to load it up on my watch, and then sometimes it doesn't play nice, and it says, oh, you've started a run on your phone. And it's like, well, I want to view it on my watch, you know? There needs to be that sort of interact with it less, automatically do what I want. If I start a run on my phone with Runkeeper, my phone and my watch should be smart enough to know, okay, this guy doesn't want to see anything on his watch except for the run right now. Let's just show him that.
Yeah. I really liked Pebble's handling of the timeline for your day and events kind of thing. They did that really well, especially in their last versions of the OS that they released. And my hope is that the Siri watch face coming in watchOS 4 captures that character for me.
Yeah. I have not messed around with watchOS 4 yet, so I've just seen videos and Apple's description of it. But I am hopeful for it. I just can't install it currently because
so you're not installing betas on your primary phone.
Yeah, well, you got to mail in your watch if it goes bad. So
yeah,
I do hope that, and I know that as of the latest beta it isn't, but I interacted with one of the watchOS developers on Twitter. And he told me to send in something, which you did on my behalf because I don't have a developer account, but hoping that they will allow more than 2 gigabytes of music on the watch because, you know, I've got like 5 gigs free on my watch. Let me fill it up with whatever I want. I don't want to put apps on it. You've mentioned this one before.
Yeah. So let me ask you. I have the first generation watch, not a Series 1, but the Series 0, if you will, or the first released watch.
Yeah.
And I was debating updating it to watchOS 4 and trying it out a little bit. But my question is, given the rumor for an LTE watch, what would you advise me? Should I sell this thing now and wait until the next thing's released and buy it? Or
I mean, you're not wearing it daily anyhow, right? So I would just sell it now to try to get a little bit more money out of it. It's cool that the first watch is still being supported. My wife has hers and she wears it every day. But everything is faster with the second generation watch. WatchOS 3 runs fine on the first gen watch. It's not bad, but just opening apps and using Siri and things like that are a lot faster with the newer processors in the newer models, both the Series 1 and the Series 2. So the first generation watch, I would say if you had that one, you're probably going to want to get the Series 3, especially if you're interested in an LTE watch. If you're not interested in LTE, then maybe the Series 2 is good for you. Wait till the 3 comes out and then buy it at a discounted price. But I've been very happy with my Series 2. The only thing is I've been running with my phone again just because of the aforementioned music issue where I can only have so much on there. And the process of transferring music to your watch is still a nightmare and they need to fix that in the software. But if the LTE watch allows me to stream my music from Apple Music or iCloud music library, that for me is going to be a game changer.
You know, you're going to laugh. You know how some people have first generation iPods still in the box in shrink wrap and speculatively sell them for $1,000 because it's still new in box kind of thing, or the first iPhone still new in box?
Yeah.
Have you seen that?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. I have one of the original watches still in shrink wrap.
Oh, boy.
Never used. You think that's going to be a hot ticket?
Probably not.
Yeah, probably not. Right. If one of our listeners wants to have a fresh watch running watchOS 1, let me know. We've talked a lot about how expensive the potential iPhone 8 is going to be. And I've been thinking about this. You know, I have people who say, when should I buy a phone? When's the right time to buy the phone? And I think my answer so far has been that the right time to buy the phone is A, when you need it, obviously, and B, when your carrier or the carrier that you decide you want to switch to has an offer that makes it worthwhile. You know, last September, there were a bunch of different offers about turning in your old phone to get an update kind of thing. In March, T-Mobile ran a special where they would give you a free iPhone 7, 32 gig if you turn in your iPhone 6. Mm-hmm. There were offers abound, and these offers come up from time to time. And The point is to watch for these offers. But if you're not going to take advantage of one of those, Apple has the iPhone upgrade program. Mm-hmm. And the upgrade program has tended to make phones available for $30 a month, $40, $45 a month. And if an iPhone 8 is around $50 a month, that is something that's totally sustainable for a number of people.
Right.
We're putting out, you know, $1,000 initially. Might not be putting out the 50 a month, could be.
And I recommend it to a lot of people if they're going to buy AppleCare because it's an interest-free loan. Like, I think taking interest on buying something like a phone or that you may break or furniture or whatever is one of the worst financial decisions you can make. But when there's no interest on it, you have nothing to lose. You're basically taking the payment you would have made up front and stretching it out over 2 years. So it's a good financial decision for people to make if you're planning to buy AppleCare. If you don't plan to buy AppleCare, then you're spending another $130. So that's the catch.
Yeah. Now, there are alternatives to AppleCare, things like SquareTrade, and I know people that have used those quite successfully for claims. Yeah. But I've always had AppleCare on my phones, and they've worked very well.
I've never had AppleCare, and I've never cracked a screen.
I have never cracked a screen, but I have exercised it on camera and on a home button that rotated funny and on battery.
I just go on and give them a hard time. They usually swap it out. Because I buy the new phone every year, mostly anyhow, go in and give them a hard time, and then they, if it's within a year, or, you know, 13 months or whatever, it may take a couple tries, but then they usually just say, okay, we'll give you the phone.
Yeah, but if you're on the 2 year program,
right? If you're going to keep
a 2 year cycle,
if you're going to keep your phone for 2 years, yeah, past that second year, it's not.
I keep thinking about the iPhone upgrade program. The only thing that concerns me about it at all is that the way the program works is that you pay all the money in, and then when the new phone is introduced, you should be able to switch to the new program, new device. Mm-hmm. You turn your device in for the newer model the following year.
Yeah.
Right? And this was the first year that it had actually run for a full year was with the iPhone 7 introduction.
Yeah.
And a number of people were disappointed to find out that at the end of their year, there were no iPhone 7s available to them.
Right. I mean, they can only make so many phones, so.
Well, that's right, except that the way that people had felt they'd understood the program was that they would be entitled to it, and certainly they were, except that they weren't available, and they were disappointed that none were set aside.
You gotta wait in line like everybody else.
Yeah, and that was never really explained.
Right. I don't know what people expected. I think it's a dumb thing to get upset.
People expected to be able to rock up and have a phone when no one else could.
And the other thing to remember is that the program does not require you to swap it out every year. That's just an option. You could just pay it off over 2 years and be done with it.
Yeah, you could. But the balance of having a new phone every year, having a new phone that has the AppleCare coverage every year, and
it's like leasing a car. You pay the payments in perpetuity, and after a certain amount of time, you can trade it in for a newer model and keep making the same payment.
Yes, except without interest, because that's better, right?
Well, when you're leasing a car, you're just paying the money anyhow. So at least you own something at the end of 2 years if you decide to stop upgrading your phone.
Right, and that's why the Apple iPhone program makes more sense than leasing a car.
Yes. Right, but the idea is they want people to just keep paying in perpetuity, much like a lease. So, you know, the idea would be you're an iPhone fanatic. You get the upgrade program because you're going to get the new phone every year anyhow. And until you're in the ground, you're going to keep getting a new phone every year, and you're going to keep paying us $50 a month. Mm-hmm. And that makes it potentially what we're getting to here is Barclays, I believe, put out a research note last week saying that they see the upgrade pricing program well-suited for the iPhone 8 because if the phone's going to cost $1,000 and up, a lot of customers are not going to be able to afford that payment right up front. But when you split that 24 ways, no interest, it ends up being under $50 a month for a service plan. So, for the upgrade plan. So, you know, that's one of those things where Apple kind of set the stage for this a couple of years ago and maybe knew that they were going to do this. It now makes it so that buying that super expensive phone is not as difficult for a lot of consumers. Assuming they can make enough iPhone 8 units, that may end up being the saving grace of the higher price.
Yeah. You know, at this point, I want to go ahead and mention something to you, our listeners. You know, I am really grateful that we have you guys out there listening, have you folks out there sending us questions and giving us feedback. And I want to make it known that we have advertising slots. From time to time, we'll read an advertisement, we'll endorse a product, things like this. And I want to open that up to all of you out there. You're our best dressed, our most handsome, our most well-groomed people. And if you have something that you'd like to advertise to all of your fellow listeners, really the best of humanity, please contact us and we'll help be happy to help set you up.
We appreciate you listening to us every week. We know we have some passionate fans out there, and that's pretty great. If you do like the show, I would encourage you to go and not only subscribe on iTunes, but leave a review for us. Especially if you like the show, we like the reviews, but even if you don't, the reviews help a lot, and it's very kind of you that go there and leave the 4- and 5-star reviews and say how great we are. So thank you.
Thank you. Now, come to the political section of our program. Mm-hmm. And this is really two stories that we ran. If you've been following national news or even world news at all, you know that there were protests and counter-protests that ended in violence in Charlottesville, Virginia. And that coincident with that, there was the President's Council on Manufacturing that had many CEOs on the board of it. And many CEOs started resigning from that board, and the president canceled that council. And there were a number of CEOs that have posted public letters responding to or commenting on the events in Charlottesville and also on that council.
Right.
And Tim Cook's contribution to that was a letter that he sent to staff, to Apple employees, really letting them know in no uncertain terms that this is an issue of morality, that human rights are an issue of morality, not just of politics, and that everyone must stand together to ensure equal rights for all. That it's not about the left, the right, conservative or liberal, it's about human decency and morality. And that Tim Cook disagrees with the president and others who believe that there's a moral equivalence between white supremacists and Nazis and those who oppose them by standing up for human rights. Equating the two runs counter to our ideals as Americans. Cook called the events in Charlottesville repulsive, and the company is donating a pair of $1 million contributions. So $1 million will be donated to the Southern Poverty Law Center, and $1 million will be donated to the Anti-Defamation League. The company is also matching employee donations to those and other human rights groups on a 2-to-1 basis through September 30th. It looks as if they're going to open up iTunes donations as well in the coming days.
Yeah, and, you know, you said this is a political issue. I don't even know that I would call this a political issue. It's just more of a human decency issue. There are some terrible people out there who stand for some terrible things and did some terrible things in Charlottesville this past weekend. And obviously our hearts go out to those that were affected by all that and the terror that occurred there. Apple has also stepped up because a lot of these racist white supremacist websites – neo-Nazi, whatever you want to call them, scumbags. They raise money through their websites. They sell goods on their websites. They're on, you know, Kickstarter and GoFundMe to fuel their hate campaigns. And a few companies at least have stood up and done something about it. And one of those is Apple. So some of these websites were selling goods or taking donations or whatever, and they accepted Apple Pay on their websites. And Apple has since stepped in and prevented that from happening. They no longer accept Apple Pay. I know that PayPal has done some of it as well. There's actually a campaign out there going on right now by a racial justice organization called Color of Change. They instituted a new initiative this week called Blood Money. And if you go to their website, bloodmoney.org, basically what they're trying to do is strong arm and pressure credit card companies into blocking some of these hate groups that are out there that are raising money for their causes, because Visa, MasterCard, American Express, and Discover all run transactions to these websites, and they take a cut, they take a share of the transaction. And so if you go on there and you scroll down, you can see who's still participating with these websites and doing business with them, essentially. And PayPal and Apple Pay are really the two that have gone out of their way thus far to stop accepting payments from these sites. And in fact, if you look at Apple Pay on the list, they are the only one that has been removed from every single hate site listed by Blood Money. So they have over 100 organizations on here that they're tracking. Apple Pay previously was only accepted at a few of them. Apple has removed Apple Pay from every single one of those pages. So good on Apple for being proactive and stepping in to do something where they can.
And, you know, this is really laudable. They didn't have to necessarily step in. Now, certainly they could have done something about the payments, but they didn't have to donate $2 million or they didn't have to match employee donations 2-to-1. They could have matched 1-to-1. They could have decided not to match at all. This is really one of the things that makes Apple such an interesting company to watch, is that they have a conscience, and that conscience extends from the top down. And they're not afraid of making that aware. You know, there are many companies out there that would write a statement late, would write a very vague statement, that would be hesitant to publish one at all. And Apple has made it very clear in no uncertain terms exactly what they find repulsive and exactly who they're going to support instead.
Right.
And that, you know, the end of the letter that Mr. Cook sent says, quotes Dr. Martin Luther King saying, "Our lives begin to end the day we become silent about the things that matter. So we will continue to speak up. These have been dark days, but I remain as optimistic as ever that the future is bright. Apple can and will play an important role in bringing about positive change."
Yeah, and good for Apple on doing all this. You know, free speech is a touchy subject in this country for a lot of reasons, and we pride it, certainly. myself being a journalist, you know, us working on this podcast, the ability to say what we want. But there's a big difference between free speech and hate speech. And sometimes people may say the lines are blurred, but in these cases of these websites, it was pretty clear what the intent was and what they were going for. And so it was great for Apple to step in and do something about it.
I would say that, you know, one of the things about free speech is that it allows us to debate topics and talk about where we align and where we disagree and things like that. I would say that from a legal and governmental standpoint, there is no distinction between free speech and hate speech. But in terms of human decency and the way that we act towards each other and the way that we honor human life and respect each other as humans, that, you know, as Tim Cook says, you can't remain silent. We have to go out of our way to reject that which is repulsive to us.
And Apple, as a private business, does not have to adhere to the same First Amendment laws that a public institution may feel compelled to do in permitting and sharing of space and stuff like that. So this is well within Apple's rights to do it, and they were right to do it.
Absolutely. Moving on to something a little easier to talk about. And I'm glad we spent time on that. You know, it's one of the things that I think about, is that what's easiest is not always right. So what's right? It's right that Tim Cook did that. It's right that Apple's done that. And it was right for us to talk about it. But it was certainly not as easy as some things like you know, the next topic, like Apple spending $1 billion on original content for up to 10 new TV shows.
Yeah, these are dark.
It's a little easier.
These are dark days right now. And it's good to see Apple doing something about it. But they also run a business. So while they have a cause, they also want to entertain you.
Apple have made a number of hires, right? They hired some people away from Sony to be part of their content team. They've hired the former president of WGN America. They've got they're amassing a group of people to put together what is going to be, or what they intend to be, a content powerhouse.
I think they're too late to the game here.
Well, okay, so let's talk about what the landscape is. Obviously, there's Netflix.
Uh-huh.
Netflix has been around for a dozen years, but Netflix has only in the past, let's say, 3 years, really begun focusing on original content. And it's been hit or miss for them. They've had some good shows.
Hit for Netflix. Netflix is doing very, very well in the original content department.
Yes, but I can think of a number of the ones that they've canceled.
They only recently canceled their first show like 2 months ago.
No.
Sense8
some of their early ones.
Yeah, like Lilyhammer, I think, was the first one that they canceled. They only did that.
Lilyhammer was from 4 years ago.
Yeah, but that was
ago.
the first one they canceled, ago. And they had it around for multiple seasons.
Yeah. Two, I think. The Sense8 died a quick death. House of Cards has finally come to an end.
I don't think so. They just had their most recent season air.
Yeah, aren't they out of material now? It's getting harder.
I don't understand what the hate is on Netflix. If you look at their batting average compared to the average broadcast television station, Netflix is hitting it out of the park. If we're gonna
it's not a matter of hate. It's just a matter of trying to look at them honestly.
Well, we can look at them honestly, and we can say, what are they canceling? Of course, they're canceled shows. Everybody's going to cancel shows. That's the way things work. Not everything can go on forever. But I mean, they bring back series limited sometimes in fashion, whatever. You know, the Wet Hot American Summer Revival just had a second season. From that movie, you know, Orange is the New Black. They have this Friday, The Defenders is coming out. You know, they have stuff that flies under the radar that comes out and it's just like dropped on a Friday and then you start hearing about it, like Santa Clarita Diet and stuff that came out earlier this year. Obviously,
I don't know that we're going to see a second
season. I don't know. It was pretty under the radar, but I mean, it was enjoyable. Obviously, people are very hyped for Stranger Things coming. That was a cultural phenomenon.
Yeah, Stranger Things season two is going to be
right. But I mean,
okay. So that's Netflix. Yeah. They have some definite wins.
HBO would love to have as many wins as Netflix does.
Old HBO used to.
Not really. They've never had more than three or four shows hot at a time. You could probably name 10 shows right now that people love on Netflix.
All right. Amazon Prime Instant Video.
Right. They've got some series as well. That just feels like a in some ways to me, like a vanity project for Jeff Bezos or something. Like they've got like 5 seasons of Mozart in the Jungle. I didn't even know this show existed. Who watches this?
They have done very well. They've got some good Emmy-winning shows. They have had some big successes.
Well, they're doing feature films now, too. I saw their very elaborate title card before. I saw The Big Sick last weekend, and Amazon Studios is responsible for that. And obviously, they won an Oscar with the Casey Affleck movie, Manchester, whatever that. Manchester by the Sea. But a lot of this content that they're making, like, you know, shows like Bosch or whatever, I wonder, like, who watches this? Like, is anybody out there?
I watched all seasons of
Bosch. Okay, well, there you go. Like, I don't.
Harry Bosch.
My problem with this and the reason I think Apple's too late to the game is I don't have time. Like, I'm kind of happy that Amazon still isn't on Apple TV just because I don't have the time to even sit down and watch Man in the High Castle. I can barely keep up on the Netflix and HBO stuff and cable and broadcast. Like, there's just way too much content out there. You can't possibly consume it all. And so why am I going to really want to sit down and watch Planet of the Apes from Apple, which is a complete piece of garbage?
That's what I'm getting at here. So Apple has a couple of stinkers out the door, right? Planet of the Apes was not a real strong success for them. Carpool Karaoke is getting terrible reviews. So they've started late. They've started on the back foot. They need to be able to come out with some new content that will help them take off where they haven't been so far. I think Amazon has been limited because Amazon has artificially limited themselves to the devices that they're able to play on. You can play Amazon Instant Video on an iPhone or on an Android device. You cannot Chromecast it. You cannot display it on an Apple TV. You can only watch it on an Amazon Fire Stick.
Well, it's coming
Fire
to Apple TV this
or
fall,
Roku.
So it doesn't matter.
It's coming to Apple TV this fall. And my understanding, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that it's going to be indexed both by voice search for Siri and also be indexed into
the TV app.
And it's
going to be a huge boon for Amazon. Yeah. It's a big win for Amazon.
It's going to be a huge boost for Amazon. That's really going to make it a first season thing where now it's available on Roku, on Fire.
And then
on
maybe
Apple
I'll sit down and watch Bosch. I don't know.
There are some good ones on Amazon Fire, on Amazon.
Yeah, I mean, I hear there's good stuff on Hulu, too. Everybody's talking about The Handmaid's Tale. I'm not going to pay for Hulu.
And Hulu is integrated into the TV app.
I'm not going to pay for Hulu and Netflix and HBO and Showtime. And, like, it's too much.
But you just said that HBO has not got a whole lot of shows going on, so kill it.
I watch Game of Thrones. I watch John Oliver. I watch Westworld. I watch Bill Maher's program. I watch a lot of things on HBO. I enjoy HBO. I was just saying that they don't have a lot going on in terms of like cultural zeitgeist buzz. There's Game of Thrones, absolutely. But they have a lot of shows that come out that, you know, like I really enjoyed The Leftovers, and they just wrapped that series a few months ago. I thought that was one of the best shows on television, but it only got one Emmy nod. It was kind of a quiet, you know, the fans were passionate, but I'm not to say that I'm not saying there's not quality on HBO. Certainly there's very high quality. It's just that the cultural relevance of a lot of those shows is not the same level as the Netflix influence right now. Netflix has a number of shows that everybody is talking about. And good for Netflix. I mean, that's awesome. And that's the thing that bothers me the most about Apple's content play, is how embarrassing it is for a company that supposedly is invested in quality and is cool and hip. You know, like, you know, say what you will about Coldplay. I think they're freaking terrible. But, you know, their alignment with bands like Coldplay or U2, it's very populist, very mainstream, safe, whatever. You know, there's not a lot of like edgy partnerships or groundbreaking stuff going on at Apple. And so when you look at their first two shows out of the gate, it just plays into that same culture that they have, where it's just like this safe, mass market, vanilla, whatever, you know, Planet of the Apps, it's reality show crap. Who cares? And now Carpool Karaoke. I mean, you know, I've seen that James Corden bit. It's fine. It's whatever. It's cute. It's mainstream nonsense. And if you really want to make an impact when it comes to entertainment and television, you have to do something that not only pleases the crowd, but also surprises them and takes them in places that they didn't expect to go, and does something new and different and shakes it up a little bit. And Apple's content play thus far has been downright embarrassing. And I think they're too late to the game. I don't think I'll really care. You know, if they come out with some really amazing, you know, show that everybody's talking about, maybe I'll check it out. But even then, it's like, so, you know, even the branding, they branded this as Apple Music, and now they're going to start putting video on it. It's just like iTunes. Like, they can't think one foot in front of them.
Here's what I want out of this stuff. I want all of these things to be in the TV app aggregated so that I don't have to care who's providing it. That's where this goes. I don't care if it comes from Apple. I don't care if it comes from Amazon. It's going to be all aggregated within the TV app.
As long as you're paying everybody $10 a month, yeah.
Well, that's where we're headed, right? That's how this happened, is that we were talking to we all had cable. We all had satellite. And we were all paying $130 a month for a lineup of channels when we were watching maybe a few handful of the channels. And All of the nerds got together and said, why can't we pay for something in a la carte? Why can't we get just what we want? Well, now you can, in the worst way possible.
Yeah, like I watch.
And that's why AT&T has the DirecTV Now, I think they call it. And they're offering an Apple TV for 3 months sign up kind of deal. All this stuff.
And it becomes a nightmare to manage it, too. They hope that you're going to get lazy and just keep paying them. Like I watch Ash versus Evil Dead on Stars. And that airs, you know, for a month and a half out of the year. I pay for 2 months of Stars and then I cancel it. Because if I buy it on iTunes and I wait for it to come out, I'm going to be 6 months behind and I'm going to pay $40 for it. Or I could pay $10 two times and be done with it and get to see it as it airs. So you spend half the price and you get it immediately and then I have to cancel it. You know, most consumers aren't going to bother with that. They're just going to go, you know what? I don't have Hulu. I don't have Stars. I don't have whatever, and I'm not going to sign up and then go back and cancel. I just never watch it. There's enough other crap out there to watch. So,
well, right, but you end up picking two or three providers, right? You pick your Netflix, you pick your Hulu, you pick your PS View, for example.
Well, that's cable, but
right. Or you pick, well, so Disney just said that they're pulling all of their stuff out of everyone else's, and they're going to launch their own.
Well, except for Star Wars and Marvel, but
and Marvel's having a ton of success on Netflix at the moment.
Well, that's a partnership with Disney. That's different. But apparently, it's to be determined what's going to happen to the Marvel cinematic films. They may not be pulled as part of the Disney deal. But Disney is going to take their own, you know, the kids' movies, Toy Story, and all that kind of stuff. And they're going to launch their own. And plus, they have all the programming they've done on Disney Channel and all that. They have millions of hours of content they've created. So, yeah, they can create their own thing and sell it to families and kids.
Yep, and it'll come either directly through them, or they can, you know, do something like buy up Verizon and partner with Verizon to distribute it through Fios.
I mean, it becomes a question at what point does it reach a saturation point, right? Because like I pay NHL Game Center so I can stream hockey throughout the season. I pay for NFL Red Zone so I can see out-of-market football games. I pay for WWE Network so I can see their live pay-per-views. I pay for, you know, all these things in addition to Netflix, in addition to my cable, in addition to my internet, in addition to whatever. And, you know, $10 doesn't sound like much until you do it a million times. And then now, look at what you're spending on all this crap.
So first of all, when you buy a bundle from an internet provider, you're getting your telephone, you're getting your internet, you're getting your TV. The price of that generally reduces the cost of each individual service so that your bundle price is the same price, right? That's the deal. You're buying these three things bundled so that you can pay a little bit lower overall rather than separately. When you unbundle and you say, I want internet only, your cost of internet goes up slightly. It's still less than the overall total, but it does go up a little bit. So that happens. You know, I think I may have told you the story of how I got fiber, right?
Yeah.
You know, I was with Time Warner Cable, and I'd been paying them for internet only, and they decided to jump the bill up and were absurd about it. They wanted to jump the bill from $89 to $129, and I told them no and went to fiber at more than triple the speed for $99. So I made a $10 increase for triple the speed. So far, that's working out pretty well for me. The services, you know, you're right. Your $10 Netflix, your $11 or $7.99, whatever it is, Hulu, depending on if you go for their non-commercials offer or not. And then you pay another $30 or $40 for channels. Now you're right back up to paying what you were paying when you had a cable bundle.
You're not actually saving any money.
Maybe more, depending on how you're buying in.
And you're missing out on channels too sometimes, because there are certain channels that you just can't get with some of these streaming providers or whatever. And you know, and your cable company is going to lock you into paying for them because you can sign on through these apps, you know, on your Apple TV. If you want to watch MTV or you want to watch whatever, you got to sign on through your cable provider on the app on your Apple TV to be able to watch it. And the cable company is going to bundle you because they know they're going to get you for the home internet. So they say, well, like you said, it's going to be cheaper if you add in TV for the total package. And then right now, like the thing that they do with Spectrum in New York, formerly Time Warner, I have a landline on my account. And the only reason I have a landline is because adding the landline makes the overall package cheaper. Why? I don't know why they do it that way, but they want to just lock you into these services. So you want to get internet alone, you're going to pay more for the internet than you would if you had bundled it with cable. And so when you add it all up, internet alone, plus your Netflix, plus your, you know, PlayStation View or whatever, and then you can't log into half these apps to actually watch them if you want to watch on demand through the app. You're spending more and it's less convenient. So a lot of people are just going to stick with cable. Someone's going to have to break through the system in some way. I hope Apple can break through the system. I have faith in them to do that. If anybody could do it, it's Apple. I just don't have faith in Apple to make good content. The only good content they've ever made are commercials, and they license that out to some of the best commercial, you know, advertising brands in the world take care of it for them.
Okay, but aren't these hires from Sony and WGN trying to pick up people who are some of the best in the world to be able to do the content in-house?
I don't know that suits and those type of people are really the ones that are the best at making those decisions. You know, I don't want to get too inside the film industry or whatever like that, but for every Kevin Feige who's done very well with Marvel, you have some idiots that basically stumble their way to success. You know, and for all these studios, when they try to do things, you know, you look at the struggles compare Kevin Feige at Marvel to what Fox did, stumbling their way until Deadpool and Logan came around with the X-Men franchise, or how they've tried to reboot Fantastic Four a number of times and it's been a disaster every time. You look at what Sony did with Spider-Man. You look at what DC and Warner has done, even though they're all under the same umbrella in trying to reboot those characters, and basically almost accidentally found success with Wonder Woman, even though the previous films in that universe were terrible. You can't trust these suits to make great decisions. You have to get good filmmakers in there, and you have to take some risks. And Apple, like you said, they're the dad genes of creating content. They are the people that want to have mass market junk, you know, popcorn, everybody's happy, leave with a smile on your face kind of stuff. I just don't.
Well, they're risk averse.
Yeah, they are. And you have to take risks in doing these things in order for them to be successful. You know, you look back on it now and it seems like a no-brainer, but for Kevin Feige and Marvel to try to do this cinematic universe was a huge risk, the likes of which had never been seen in film. And they were doing that before they were even owned by Disney. They started laying that down. So, and it obviously paid off for them in big ways, but creatively you have to take some risks. You have to do something. And a reality show starring Gwyneth Paltrow and Will.i.am, yeah.
And
Jessica Alba talking about apps while somebody comes down a giant escalator is, as far as generating buzz or excitement or getting people to talk about your network or your service going, it's just a big wet fart.
Well, that's an appealing vision. Here I was about to propose that you and I should do our own app show.
It would be better than that crap. At least we'd have some interesting opinions and it wouldn't be all gimmicks.
Well, and we'd talk about what the business part of the app is and whose problem you're trying to solve and how does this all work and why is it a thing that anyone needs.
Well, and it wouldn't be so formulaic, too. I mean, you know, these reality show templates that are out there where, you know, it's so clearly edited in such stupid ways and, you know, everything has to be, you know, this certain structure. It's embarrassing. It's downright embarrassing. And I hope that the executives coming in, I hope the suits can do something good. But from what I've seen of the entertainment industry, a lot of times even those guys are just kind of like, they don't really have good taste. It's usually the filmmakers and the creators themselves that are the ones that have the taste and the vision. And the execs are just like bean counters.
Yeah. Well, we're going to move from execs to specs. And the spec here is a little PSA that we have about Thunderbolt 3 cables.
Yeah, just so very quickly, I would encourage people to check out this article. Thunderbolt 3 cables right now are a mess. Generally speaking, if they're longer than a half a meter, they don't offer USB 3.1 speeds for USB connections. Some of them have different bandwidth throughputs when doing Thunderbolt. Some of them don't have the full power rated capabilities to power, say, like a 15-inch MacBook Pro. Even Apple's own cable that ships with the MacBooks doesn't do high-speed data transfers. It only does USB 2 data transfers because it's intended as a power cable, not a data cable. So right now, the USB-C slash...
This is a garbage.
Yeah, fun. USB-C slash Thunderbolt 3 is a mess. USB-C is a port, not a technology. USB 3.1 is the technology. It can be used in tandem with Thunderbolt 3, but there are limitations. Check out the article. Get caught up to speed. You'll be probably even more confused than you were when you started. But like you said, it's a garbage fire.
Yeah, there are seven different USB-C cables. Some of them Thunderbolt 3, some of them not. All different specs, all different transfer speeds. And the problem is that you go to the store. You're going to buy whatever cable is cheapest because you're budget-minded. And that cable will not actually do what you think it should. An identical looking cable that costs lots more will actually accomplish
and
what you intend to accomplish.
And then a lot of people
and is
and
shorter,
then a lot of people aren't even going to realize
this is nuts,
and
right? They're
just going to plug it in, and it's going to be like when HDTVs first came out, and people just had standard def stretched to fill up the whole picture and thought that they were getting the full picture.
It's worse though. It's even worse than that because you're going to go to a store, and you're going to go to the Apple store, and Apple's going to have this cable for you. And they'll have a couple of other ones, and you'll buy one.
You'll buy the Apple cable.
And
you'll buy the Apple cable, and you'll have USB 2 speeds. So, yeah, it's stupid.
So, a valid question is, how in the heck did Apple allow us to get into this situation?
Because they embraced open standards.
What was the point? Yeah.
If they had made their own port, it wouldn't be an issue, but then people would freak out because Apple made their own port to compete with other devices. So they pushed adoption of USB-C. They may have pushed it a little too quickly. And now they're caught in the crossfires of an industry trying to figure itself out.
Okay. So you buy a Thunderbolt 3 accessory. It comes with an 18-inch cable. That cable is useless.
Yep. You can blame the Thunderbolt 3 manufacturers for that, for bundling cheap cables with it. You can blame Apple for that, for bundling a cheap cable with theirs. But
Anything longer than 18 inches can be passive or active. The passive ones had lower speed. The active ones have transceivers in them, but they cost more because they have transceivers in them, and your speed is still limited to USB 2 speeds. It's
Moving on.
All right. So we've talked about the iPhone 7S passively sort of in these past few months and weeks. And mostly we've said it's going to be nearly identical. The understanding is that it's not going to be absolutely identical. It's going to be nearly identical. So you're going to get a slightly thinner lens bump on the back, but that otherwise it's going to be slightly larger in all dimensions.
Yeah, the belief is that to make it more durable, because they're supposedly switching to a glass chassis, which will allow for contact-based inductive wireless charging, much like the glass back of the Apple Watch. The structure of it will be a little more solid if it's a little bit thicker. So the iPhone 7S and 7S Plus may be slightly thicker and won't fit your cases from your iPhone 7. I don't see this as that big of a deal.
No. Hold on. So depending on the case, your cases for an iPhone 7 may well
they
fit
could.
7.
I mean, iPhone 6 cases fit the 6S kind of. They were a bit more snug because the 6S, the aforementioned bend gate issue, Apple went with a different metal material and made the aluminum thicker. So the 6S was slightly thicker than the 6. But it could be a situation like that where some of the cases won't fit, some will.
Yeah, and the dimensions that we have. So an iPhone 7 is 138.3 millimeters by 67.1 millimeters by 7.1 millimeters. A 7S is rumored to be 138.44 millimeters by 67.27 millimeters by 7.21 millimeters. So
Apple will make new cases specifically for the 7S if that's the case, so it will fit better. They did the same thing with the 6S versus the 6.
Of course they will. And I'm just thinking about third-party manufacturers. You know, this is something that Apple has done for ages, whether it was the 4 and the 4S or the iPad 2 to the iPad 3, where the iPad 3 was in fact thicker, but iPad 2 cases still fit. That generally there is a better designed case for the specific device, but that the previous generation ones may fit close enough.
Yeah, I don't see this as that big of a deal. But you also have to consider that if you put a case on your phone and it covers the back, then you might prevent it from doing the wireless charging. So we will find out in a month.
We will know more when we know more. Let's see here. Oh, I have a topic that is right up your alley, Neil. I have one just for you.
I'm ready.
Are you ready? Are you sitting down? More smart connector products for iPad Pro are coming.
Thank the Lord.
And it's not just a rumor. It's a conversation between manufacturers and Apple. And Apple itself says that vendors have products in the
pipeline. I'm excited to see what they do. I hope it's more than keyboards. I imagine it's going to be a lot of keyboards, which is fine. I'm in the process of reviewing the Logitech latest keyboard, the Slim whatever, Slim Combo, and it's fine. You know, different keyboards are going to suit different needs. Thicker ones that make it more like a laptop. Some people like that.
I have the Bridge.
The Bridge is great. I love the Bridge. I would love to see a Bridge keyboard with a smart connector. But I would also like to see musical instruments and docking stations. And, you know, I don't know what the technical limitations are of the smart connector. Obviously, it's not going to be able to handle as much bandwidth as a Lightning port does.
Which is where I'd worry about musical instruments.
But it would be nice to be able to imagine if you had a few accessories that you used with your iPad, like you had a microphone that you plugged into it and you wanted to do a wired keyboard and all that, and you wanted to just use them on a desk with a docking station. And, you know, it would be nice to just be able to plop it down, have it connect with a smart connector, and just have it turn into whatever you need at that moment. And then you want to take your tablet on the go, you can do that. I think there's a lot of potential for that kind of stuff. And I could see myself doing that.
What I see that people like about it is just the speed of being able to connect or disconnect without having to actually worry about how that connection is made or how it physically fits. You just, boom, it works, bing, bing, bang, boom, ready to go kind of thing. And it's certainly easier than Bluetooth pairing. But I have to say, you know, you're reviewing that Logitech. I had the Bridge for iPad Pro, the 12.9-inch one.
That was
a nice keyboard.
I still have mine.
I will be writing it up for us.
I have the one for the 9.7-inch, and I think it's a great product. I mean, again, it's thick, it's heavy, but it turns your iPad into a laptop, and it
The yes. hinges are excellent. Yeah. You know they are.
It looks good.
Made out of aluminum.
It looks good. It's a good product. And if that had smart connector, it would be an even better product.
Well, they, you know, Bridge commented for this article. They said that they believe that the implementation is a little bit problematic, that it limits it for vendors. That, you know, looking ahead for them, there's no reason why the smart connector wouldn't be considered for future Bridge products if the application is right. And you know, I understand what they're talking about. First of all, there's just the physical limitations of it is you have these two hinges to make it into a laptop kind of arrangement. What do? Put the smart connector on a flex cable or, you know, how do you make that work in a way that isn't messy?
You know, considering it can charge the iPad and it does data in two directions and can send power out to devices like a backlit keyboard, I see a lot of potential there for not just keyboards, for unique ways of turning the iPad into something else. And I am hopeful that Apple works something out with manufacturers, maybe gets the licensing down a little easier, what have you. But let's see some cool new stuff. Let's make it a pro iPad.
Let's make the iPad pro again. That was terrible. But speaking of things that are not terrible, I have CarPlay to talk about. So in this latest week we've had, the week that was, Sony has given people a preview of the XAV-AX200, which is a terribly named product, Apple CarPlay support radio. The unit is a 6.4-inch touchscreen, also runs Android Auto, has a DVD player, has Bluetooth, steering wheel input, supports FLAC for lossless audio via USB, and has SiriusXM radio support, which is very cool. They have 4-volt preamp outs, which is not terrible. It's not the most we've ever seen, but it's certainly acceptable. And they're doing 55 watts per channel inside. What's interesting for some of our listeners about this one is, so there's this debate that goes on every time we publish about CarPlay, and you see it in the comments. And some people want as large a screen as possible. Give me that 6.9-inch screen. Use everything that you can do on a doubled-in unit and make it all touchscreen. And some people love that. Some people, the other people, reject that entirely and say, you know what? What I really need is a strip of buttons and a knob. Yeah. I want a volume knob. I want a mode knob. I want physical controls to touch. And when you do, that means sacrificing some of the screen size, which is what Sony has done here. Sony gives you a 6.4-inch display because they have a left panel control strip. And the control strip has a home button. It has a knob for both pushing and controlling options as well as doing volume. And it's got forward and back controls on it. Those things, if you're the sort of person that really desires having a physical control, this might be the unit for you. What I like about this from the look of it is that, so a couple of years ago, there was a JBL unit, a JBL CP100, that as far as I can tell, never actually released, but it was a beautiful unit. It was simplified down to just the bare basics of what you absolutely had to have to do CarPlay well, to do a radio well, and had just a few short buttons on it. And this Sony looks like the rebirth of that concept. It looks like it delivers on the promise of what JBL was trying to do, and I'm hopeful that it does. So we will try and get one of those in here to be able to evaluate it more deeply for you. In the past week, we've had the wireless CarPlay unit from Alpine installed, the ILX107, and I have to say that's been brilliant. It really has. We've had some good questions from listeners. Some of our best educated listeners have asked questions like, when you have two phones associated with it, when you get in the car at the same time, what does the unit do? What does it associate with? And one of the things we learned is that when you have two phones that are paired with a wireless CarPlay unit, that whichever phone was in use last by it is the one that dominates the connection. And that it's very easy in Alpine's version of their settings, within two taps, to be able to change to the other phone. There's a phone's icon in the upper right display of the radio in its home screen. So you tap once there and it shows you all the phones and whether or not they're connected, or you can delete them or manage them. And so you just tap connect to the other one and it takes over. It's really slick. The other good question we had this week was about using backup cameras. And all of these systems are capable of working with backup cameras, but they're all capable for sure with aftermarket ones. And aftermarket backup cameras are available anywhere from $20, $25 on up to as much as $150. And some of the car radio manufacturers are bundling the backup camera with the radio. So if you get some of the Pioneer units, for example, the camera comes in the box for some of their newer units. The thing to say specifically about this is that what if your car already has an OEM backup camera installed on it from the manufacturer? And for that, the same thing that applies to steering wheel controls applies, which is there's very likely an adapter that can help you adapt the connector on your OEM camera to the stereo that you just have to check and see what compatibility is like from the interface makers, which are usually things like Pack Audio or Metra or Access Interface, which is part of Metra. They tend to provide the adapters for these sorts of things. And I would say this, if your OEM camera is not easily adapted to work with an aftermarket system, that I would consider replacing the camera with one of the $25 units and use the same mounting, modify the mounting for the original one. The signals you have to do backup camera are a reverse signal to tell the radio when to look for the camera and when to switch to the camera interface. You have to have power to the camera and of course the video signal itself. And you can actually combine the power and reverse signal into one if you use the signal off of the backup bulbs as your signal for when to switch to reverse mode and when to power the camera. By virtue that you'll put the transmission in reverse, it'll apply power to the backup lights, and that will share power over to the signal input for reverse signal to the radio and powering on the camera. So you really only need four connections, which are positive and ground. So the camera, video itself, and the power, which doubles as the reverse signal. So it's not that hard to do, and there are options available to you whether or not you're going to use the OEM camera or an aftermarket one. But I have been very impressed with wireless CarPlay. So far, battery life is not really seriously impacted by using it wirelessly. There's some battery impact because you have to run the wireless Bluetooth and Wi-Fi antennas on the phone. But it hasn't really drained it down very fast, just driving around town with it on. And there's a major convenience factor to it, which is, you know, when I get into the other car that has wired CarPlay, if I'm just going for a short trip, I may not remember or bother to plug in the phone. But if I step into the other car that has the wireless CarPlay installed in it, it's just on.
Nice.
And it's on fast. And it works brilliantly. It really does. One of the things that's an interface thing that has changed is that you, of course, get a battery signal on the CarPlay deck itself. Traditionally, you get a blue bar up at the top of the menu bar on the phone, showing that you're connected to CarPlay, the same kind of blue bar that you'd get showing you that you were connected to a personal hotspot. With wireless CarPlay, that is purple now. So I'm not sure what the meaning of that is or why they changed it, but it is now purple at the menu bar. Yeah. So all very cool. And I continue to be impressed. Right now, Alpine is the only one doing wireless CarPlay in the aftermarket world. And that radio is the ILX-107, which is 100 more than the, and by 100 more, I mean numerically, than the last year's model. It was the ILX-007, which was their first wireless CarPlay. The thing that Alpine gets right that everyone else could do some improving on is that there's always this distinction between the CarPlay interface and the radio interface. And the radio interface comprises its settings and its other inputs and FM radio kind of thing. And where Alpine really shines is that Alpine took a look at the human interface guidelines for iOS.
That's good.
And copied them pretty faithfully. Every menu, every system view, every toggle switch for on-off in Alpine's world looks faithfully like iOS. The volume overlay, when you turn volume up and down on the radio, you get a rounded rectangle with numbers in the center of the display, just as if you were seeing that kind of thing on Mac or on iOS when you volume up and down. Instead of the big speaker icon, they just show you the large numbers because seeing a big speaker icon is not as helpful. But it's that same gray overlay in the center. It's every part, I tell you, everything about it makes it look like it was designed for iOS because, well, it was. And it's good. You know, and that's really the best thing you can do for an older car, right? Is people drive their cars for 10 years or more these days. Change the entertainment system. It's like having a whole new car. It is. This one, like the Pioneer, comes with a GPS antenna that augments the GPS ability for maps, for Apple Maps. You know, where with your phone inside the car acts as a shield kind of thing, preventing the signals from maybe locating as quickly. They have an accessory antenna that plugs into the back of the radio, and that works in conjunction with Apple Maps, so it gives you a good, strong GPS signal.
Yeah, sounds like good. How much does it cost?
Don't remember off the top of my head. That will be in our review that we'll post on appleinsider.com. Well, we've come to the end of another perfectly good episode of Apple Insider Podcast.
You can find me on Twitter at thisisneil, N-E-I-L, and you can read me on appleinsider.com.
I'm Victor Marks. I'm at vmarks on Twitter. You can read my writings on appleinsider.com. I want to remind you that if any of you have products or services that you'd like to advertise to our listenership of really the best educated, best dressed, best informed people on the internet, please get in touch with us. I and Neil Dad Jeans Hughes will be back next week with more Apple Insider Podcast.